here will be a terrible, terrible time of suffering of our people. If you study the history of gun disarmament throughout the world over the centuries, you find out that the greatest killer of human beings is government. And Larry probably will elaborate on that, but certainly they disarmed the Jewish people in Germany before they put them into the Holocaust concentration camps. They disarmed the people of Russia before they put them in the concentration camps. They disarmed the people of China before they began their genocidal programs. They disarmed the Christians in Rwanda before they hacked 800,000 of them to death. As Bill Clinton's administration was saying to their members, don't use the word genocide. If you use the word genocide, we'd have to intervene. But you always disarm the people before you would either enslave them or certainly have a mass murder and genocide. Well, with that as a background, Larry Pratt, thank you so very much for being with us late at night back there in Virginia.
Well, thank you for having me on. It's really good to be with you, Stan.
Well, we always enjoy it. Will you pick up the story and tell us what's going on and your take on this effort to certainly have us register our guns or take away our guns or keep us from buying guns or keep us from buying ammunition? What motivates these people on the other side, and how successful is it when you disarm the people in the name of preventing crime?
Well, we're told that registration of guns is an essential crime-fighting tool. However, when you look at what actually is the record of registration, you find out that there's something quite different. Hawaii has had registration of handguns since the 30s, as has Canada. Neither one of those jurisdictions has ever once solved a crime using their handgun registry. And basically, it's the simple fact that when a crime occurs, the perpetrator almost never leaves the gun behind, and if he were, the chances would be somewhere between slim and none that the gun ever had been registered to him. Instead, he's using a stolen gun, a gun that was obtained somehow from other criminals, and certainly not one that he stood in line for so that the government could get all the information recorded in their little books. I had a police officer call in one time. I was doing a television show in Philadelphia, and she said, in all of my 18 years, neither I nor anyone that I've worked with has ever arrested somebody who had a gun registered to their name. So registration really isn't very useful. In fact, in a way, I've had my own experience with it during the Beltway sniper episode. And I live right around the Beltway of Washington, D.C., in Northern Virginia. This guy was terrorizing people. Some of us were on the lookout for him in the hopes that we might be able to solve his problem. But the police didn't know what they were looking for. They had this charming theory that it was an economic failure, a white guy in a white van, and that was what was motivating him. So, hey, are we coming up on a break?
We are coming up on a break here.
Okay, I thought I could hear that, so why don't I pick it up on the other side?
All right, fine. We'll let you do that. Our guest, of course, is Larry Pratt of Gun Owners of America. We'll be back in just a moment to evaluate how successful is gun registration, and what about gun confiscation? Does that cut back on crime? Well, you go right ahead, Larry.
Okay, sniper then was supposed to be a white guy, an economic failure, and that was what was driving him to these terrible deeds, and he was driving in a white van. The roadblocks that stopped so many white vans, and you'd drive by and some poor guy's face down on the macadam with his hands behind his back. Of course, that wasn't who the guy was. In fact, I told the media at the time, and they were going, I should not leave this out, they were going door to door having obtained the records of everybody. For some reason they figured he was in the Maryland suburbs. Everybody that had bought a rifle using the caliber that was being used by the sniper, they'd gotten the records of those. They had to go store to store, but nevertheless, they had a registration list. So keep that in mind, folks. When you go to buy a gun and the dealer asks you to fill out these federal forms, you're putting yourself, I'm putting myself, we're all putting ourselves on a federal registration list when we buy a gun in that fashion. And I said, as they were going door to door, I said, they're not going to find the perpetrator that way. They're not going to find the gun until they first find the perpetrator. Well, that's exactly what happened. They found the gun cradled in the arms of one of the two killers as they both slept, two black men sleeping in a dark car, and they were not motivated by their economic failure. They were motivated by Islam. So the police were totally wrong. Now, not that having a profile is a bad idea. That should be able to help, but it would help to have a better profile. And the black police chief of Montgomery County, who, for the discomfort of all the rest of us, and who knows how many lives lost because of his prejudice, he just couldn't get it through his head that this might be, first of all, a black person, and more importantly, somebody who was motivated by radical Islam. And so they spent their time chasing their tails, and finally, I was the one with no police experience who was proven correct as to how they were going to find the gun. So much for registration. But I have to concede, registration is effective in one regard. Registration is a wonderful tool for tyrants to collect at least most of the guns, certainly all the registered guns, so that they won't encounter resistance when they go to oppress the people, and if in their view, if need be.
Hold on, Paul. We're going to be right back here in just a moment with Larry Pratt. Well, Dr. Stan, Chris, Larry was telling us the story of the sniper Muhammad and his cohort who were going around shooting people in the Virginia area there, three or four years ago, and of course they were actually had lists of everybody who had a rifle of that caliber. You see, they keep these lists. They're not supposed to. It's illegal to keep the list, but they don't really care about legality. They want a list of everybody who has a gun. And, of course, the whole idea of gun registration has nothing to do with identifying criminals. It gives them the list of guns, so when they want to collect the guns, they can, and they've done this in country after country, saying, we would never collect your guns. We just want this registry to control crime, and they're simply lying. It's not like the Social Security number. We would never use the Social Security number for anything but Social Security. You can trust us because we're from the government, and the history of government is always that there are people there who have a different worldview. They want to control the masses, and unfortunately, it is government that has killed more people during the last century than all the tyrants in the world put together previously. So pick up the story there, Larry.
Well, and in fact, we could even allow that perhaps in some cases, registration was actually in the mind of the government officials who were perpetrating it, it was hoped to control criminal activity, whether it was the imposition of gun control in Germany designed to try to suppress radical elements and common criminals, or whether it was Batista in Cuba in the hopes that people like Fidel Castro would be kept from getting guns to threaten his government. Well, both were wrong, so whether they had population control and even worse thoughts in mind, or whether they were just stupid, they've never learned. They keep repeating the same mistakes, if they are, and if they don't take advantage of gun control as a tool of tyranny, then it's very possible that the one who comes after them will take advantage of them. Thank you very much for having given me this very important tool in my little toolbox of oppression. Of course, the irony is that these folks that are the tyrants, that are really the killers, they get their guns from illegal sources anyway. Castro was able to get his guns from foreign supply brought in to the many beaches, through the many beaches of Cuba, and same with Hitler. He didn't rely on legal gun trade to get his guns, at least not until he was the government. And then there were people carrying concealed firearms. They were called the SS and other groups of state oppression. So it's just an amazing thing that people continue to advocate the same thing, liberals, socialists in the population, that really have an antipathy toward firearms, and they are so indoctrinated in our government schools that they simply will not acknowledge the facts when you show them the facts. Well, we'll do it right this time. It's kind of like Ted Kennedy. When Milton Friedman was testifying before him back in the 80s, something provoked Friedman to make the comment that in 6,000 years of recorded human history, socialism has been tried practically every year throughout that whole time, and it's always failed. And Kennedy immediately shot back, and rather angrily and haughtily, that's because I was not doing it. So, I mean, people like that are just not going to learn, because they always assume, I guess, as does Ted Kennedy, that I'll do it right. Those other people were just a bunch of pikers.
Well, could you tell us what actually has happened in Australia, where they registered the guns, where they actually confiscated many of the guns, and certainly in Great Britain, when they took away literally all the weapons from the people? Did that really then cut down on the incidence of crime?
No, it certainly did not. Australia has seen an increase in their violent crime. It's not as bad as it is in Britain, and I would submit for the simple reason that they only confiscated all of the legally owned semi-automatic firearms, both handguns and long guns, leaving people with revolvers and bolt-action rifles and double-barrel shotguns, things like that. But in England, other than a few farmers who have to keep their shotguns locked up in a safe unless they're shooting varmint, if they so much as even think about using that shotgun for self-defense, they will go to jail. A farmer by the name of Tony Martin, living in, interestingly, a little village called Norfolk, the namesake for the rather large city in this side of the pond, Tony Martin had been repeatedly burgled by a gang, and finally decided he'd had enough. They were driving him into bankruptcy, and so he heard him coming up his stairs one night. This is pretty brazen, and this is typical of home invasions in England. The invaders simply do not give a rip whether there's somebody home or not, because they know they have the legal advantage. In fact, what we would call the Attorney General said not too long ago that burglars have rights too. They're part of the community. So, anyway, Tony hadn't gotten that memo. He figured they'd cut themselves off from the community. They were driving him to ruin. And so as these two chaps were coming up the stairs, he let off with a blast or two, and he killed one and wounded the other. Well, Tony was given a life sentence in jail. And the other guy barely saw the inside of a jail. I mean, he's a poor victim, you know. And his lawyer went to some, I think it was a municipal board, but who knows, funded maybe by the national taxpayer. In any case, he went to this government entity to get legal aid to finance his lawsuit that he wanted to bring on behalf of his poor client against Tony Martin for damages, because this poor guy had been so terribly wounded and all that, which was actually a bunch of baloney. And I think it was around that point that the British public rose up. Tony Martin finally was cut some slack, and after 5 years, he was finally let out. But now the poor guy, the gang has vowed revenge, can't live in his farmhouse. It's in a very remote area, and British police protection is an oxymoron. There is no such thing as police protection. And so Tony has now been reduced to living out of his car in addresses unknown so that these gang members can't catch up with him and finish him off.
And, of course, what insanity is this? Well, you have to understand that what they have done is take away the right of the British people to defend themselves from the marauders, from the criminals, and that's just what they want to do here. In fact, in Washington, D.C., our nation's capital, where they have disarmed all of the law-abiding citizens, it is known as the murder capital of the world. Even the police there have advocated that the people have a right to have weapons because they realize they can't get there to protect them. And more people are killed in our nation's capital than any other place in this country as a result of the fact that the people are totally disarmed. How could you do such a bad job?
And it's worth noting that the most vocal of the police to speak out on behalf of an armed citizenry has been, and not just once or twice, but over the years, it's been the Black Patrolmen's Association spokesman. They've been the one. In fact, Maurice Turner, when he was alive, a black man who was the police chief in Washington, D.C., actually advocated trashing the gun ban and making it so that people could have guns in their homes for self-defense. He was very outspoken in this, and obviously, I guess, his views hadn't been that well known when he was elevated to chief of police. I'm not sure had they known his views, they would have appointed him, because typically these bedwetting socialist politicians that run so many of our cities are not looking for independent thinkers. They don't want to hear somebody tell them the way the world actually works. They want people who will say yes, sir, to whatever silly idea, dangerous idea they have for how they want to make the world work. And, you know, if they pass an ordinance that says in the District of Columbia the law of gravity is suspended, well, I guess they expect police cars to be able to drive around by gravity suspension.
Well, anyway, what happened, though, to the police chief there? I understood that he'd gotten in some real trouble for suggesting that the people should have the the constitutional right to keep weapons.
Yeah, he was controversial, and he eventually retired and is no longer living, which is a real shame because I struck up an acquaintance with him, and he was a delightful guy, and it was just so full of common sense. And I was looking forward when he, after his retirement, to working with him as a spokesman to really be an effective lobbyist and a voice for common sense, but that didn't work out that way. But Maurice Turner, anyway, was somebody that I thought was one of the best. And they have this sad sack chief of police with her long blonde hair right now, and I'm sorry. But when I look at her and I see the kinds of, or hear the kinds of things that come out of her mouth, it's just, it's been a long way from Maurice Turner. She mouths the same shibboleths that come out of the mouths of the politicians that have appointed her about the gun ban being such an important crime-fighting tool for the District of Columbia. First time I heard one of those Jaspers say that, I had to laugh. It really doesn't pass the laugh test when they say that this is such an important crime-fighting tool. Gadzooks, if they get any more crime-fighting tools like that, we're going to have to move the beltway out a lot wider so we can dig a ditch around.
And basically, the more guns you have in the hands of law-abiding citizens, the less crime. We'll go right ahead there, Larry.
Okay. Well, in fact, they're still making this argument, this crazy argument that the gun ban is an important crime-fighting tool. It's one of their major arguments that they've presented to the Supreme Court when the arguments were held over the D.C. gun ban having been overturned in a federal appeals court. They were just shocked. And I thought that the appeals court judge wrote a rather good opinion and didn't leave the district a whole lot to stand on, so they started, in addition to their rather weak arguments, the collectivist view, as it's called, that you don't have an individual right to keep and bear arms, that you can only have a right to bear arms if you belong to, say, the militia of the state of New York or Maryland or whatever it might be. They began to realize that maybe the day was coming when that argument wasn't going to fly. So they started packing in a lot of arguments about how this was a very important crime-fighting tool for them. And, you know, they may not believe that. Maybe this is just something that they're using as part of their con. What do I know? I can't get inside their head. But they must, if they don't believe it themselves, then they're even more arrogant than they look, because they must believe that other people believe it. It's kind of like the crook that gets caught red-handed and, you know, the old gag line, well, who do you believe, me or your lying eyes?
Right. And, of course, the thing is, how
this
could you...
This is what I see coming out of the mouths of these district officials. These people are beyond belief.
But, of course, the trouble is that people are dying because of it. And
That's exactly right.
And in the areas where people actually have the right to keep weapons in their home, when the areas where people have even the right to have concealed weapons and carry those weapons, the incidence of crime goes down. Why? Because the criminal knows that you're not going to be able to get away scot-free. And I'll tell you that the criminals will tell you, and I understand people have actually interviewed them, saying, you know, we're not going to go into that house. Why? People might very well have a gun there and we might get shot. So
right.
They'll go to some area where they know that there is no, of course, means of protecting the individual. And then they can have, of course, free hand as far as robbing or raping or pillaging. And what insanity it is, I believe personally, that there are people out there who know exactly what they're doing, and they're using these sophistic arguments because they want to disarm the population so they can control them. And we see that with Dianne Feinstein, Senator Dianne Feinstein from California, who, when she was the mayor of San Francisco, insisted on having a gun permit so she could protect herself. And yet, of course, she consistently has opposed anybody else having a gun permit to protect themselves.
So it's different in her case,
Michael,
and that's the compelling argument that a lot of these socialists make. Well, it's different.
Well, of course, these people give hypocrisy a bad name, and that is the problem that we have.
Yeah. In fact, I've mentioned to you on other occasions, but I just love it, so bear with me, that back in the 80s when Mayor Jane Byrne of Chicago was advocating before the city council that they pass an ordinance banning handguns, which they subsequently did, that she made the statement that, why, there's something wrong if people think they need a gun. Well, she was surrounded by six uniformed, very well-armed officers right there in the city council chambers. Now, the only thing I can say to people like Feinstein and Byrne and others who either pack their own heat or have... People like Charlie Schumer has an off-duty, supposedly.
Hold that
thought.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Larry is talking about, of course, the politicians who actually have armed guards to protect them, but, of course, object to the individual having a weapon to protect themselves. And he was talking about Charlie Schumer, apparently. Senator Schumer hires is this man an armed guard that protects him?
Well, I'd be interested to know if he hires him or whether the man is just assigned by the city of New York. That's a detail that somehow inquiring newsmen, to my knowledge, haven't ferreted out. But anyway, you've got a New York City detective flying to Washington with him and sort of sticking to him like a shadow, an armed detective from the police department in New York City. Now, I personally would be perfectly comfortable in most cases running around without a gun myself if I thought I had somebody like that that would be at my beck and call. So things always look different when you have a situation like that. But what hypocrites these people are. And of course, Schumer's really a rich case, because he will tell you, asking, he's a supporter of the Second Amendment. Of course, he's never seen a gun control law he didn't like. But then he's not that much different, really, from what the Bush administration has done, because they submitted a brief in this D.C. court case, this D.C. gun ban case, that pretty much fit with Charlie Schumer's hypocrisy, or Dianne Feinstein, or whoever. They said, oh, yeah, the Second Amendment protects an individual right to keep and bear arms. Absolutely. Predates the coming into being of the American Republic. And when I read that part of their brief, I thought, boy, this is good. Well, and in it, to a certain extent, it is, because it certainly bashes the many federal district court rulings that have held to the collective view that it's a only states really have a right, and you have a derivative right as a member of the New York State Militia, and any other person doesn't have any right to have a firearm, and bans are just fine for them. Argument that Bush made then went on, though, and it was, you know, after the but that was the gotcha, because then they were saying that if it were reasonable to a federal judge to say that this gun, that gun, or all guns, like in the District of Columbia, seemed reasonable, well, then that's all it would take, and you could then have the right to keep and bear nothing. But you'd have that individual right. And this is a concept that the rulers in the 1984 novel of George Orwell would just have had to have loved. Slavery is freedom. War is peace. And you have an individual right to keep and bear nothing. And this started back early in the Bush administration when John Ashcroft was the Attorney General. He wrote an advisory opinion to the U.S. attorneys that all work under the Justice Department and ultimately the Attorney General, that the Second Amendment protected an individual right to keep and bear arms. And a lot of people saw that part of the letter and thought, oh, this is great. You know, the Bush administration is really getting it right. But they didn't read the whole letter because there was this little but right at the bottom. Yeah, but subject to, of course, reasonable regulation. Well, there's the ball game. Subject to nothing, says the Second Amendment, shall not be infringed. And so we kind of saw this problem coming because, after all, there had been these kinds of warnings. So we put in our friend of the court brief, and I would invite people to go look at it at gunowners.org. They'll find a tab for a whole collection of things, an index of things, including our brief, and I don't want to forget to mention what the state of Montana did. But in our brief, we figured that it would be important to emphasize this notion that, indeed, the Second Amendment shall not be infringed. So we went back to an early 19th century dictionary and took out the definition of infringed, because we figured they might need a little help in understanding what that word means. And then we did something that our attorneys actually asked me if I was comfortable with us doing, because it would border on contempt of court. And when they told me that, of course, I was really interested, because, of course, it's hard not to be in contempt of court. So many things they do are contemptible. But what we pointed out to the court was that, okay, the founding generation had put up with a long string of abuses, and their petitions about that had fallen on deaf ears, and finally they had been pushed to where they had to fight back. And similarly, this generation is watching to see what the Supreme Court will do in this case.
Hold that thought, we'll be right back.
Okay.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest, of course, is Larry Pratt. And of course, was that actually included in the brief, that this generation is watching to see what the courts are going to do?
It most definitely is. If I recall, it may be on page 37, but it's in there.
Was that the brief that was prepared by Ted Sorensen? He actually sent us a copy of that.
No, ours was prepared by our two attorneys, lead attorneys, including Herb Titus, and then another fellow, Bill Olson. Herb Titus has a long history of politically incorrect practice of law. he's kind of specializes in appellate law and constitutional law. Well, then the state of Montana came along, and oh my goodness, just when I thought maybe we had put in pushing the envelope, I realized that us Eastern boys don't really know what pushing the envelope is. They didn't file a friend of the court brief, but the Secretary of State, through a letter to the editor in the Washington Times, I'm sure got the attention of the Supreme Court. The Secretary pointed out that the state of Montana, which is a Democrat-controlled state at this point, legislature is led by Democrats, the governor's a Democrat, they had passed a resolution, non-binding, but it was intended as a shot across the bow, resolution almost unanimous in the legislature, signed by the governor, and a lot of other state officials wanted to get their signature on it just to show how much support the concept that was in the resolution had. And then they went on in this resolution to point out that if the court were to rule that the Second Amendment does not protect an individual right, which I don't think they have to worry, I think the court will rule that way, kind of like the Bush administration, yeah, but. And if, and here's where I think the game is, if the court were to rule that they could infringe the Second Amendment when it says so clearly shall not be infringed, that would put the continuing validity of the 1889 compact where Montana entered the Union, that would put the continuing validity of that compact into question.
In other words, they would might very well consider withdrawing from the Union if the federal government violates its own laws.
And, of course, the really politically incorrect word would be secede. But, yes, that is exactly what they were saying. And I thought, God bless them, because they've introduced a little reality to the Supreme Court. Where
hold that thought right there. We're going to be back in just a moment with Larry Pratt here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Larry is actually talking about the Supreme Court, the hearing of this case, the gun laws in Washington, D.C., and the fact that I hadn't heard this, but apparently the state of Montana had said that passed a resolution, and the governor had signed it, saying that if the Supreme Court were to say that the Second Amendment did not give the people the individual right to keep and bear arms, then Montana might consider the pact that they'd signed when Montana became a state in the Union, because, of course, the federal government would be reneging on the Second Amendment and the Bill of Rights, and that would, of course, then give some justification for Montana to secede from the Union. Now, you haven't heard that story. Of course, they don't want the average individual to understand that, but I think this is a very, very important issue.
Oh, my. What they did was just... I have trouble describing how important I think it is, but I think it's very critical, and we've got it certainly on our website. So if you go to gunowners.org and then look for the tab that talks about Heller versus DC versus Heller or DC gun banner, whatever we've called it, and then when you click there, not only would you find our brief, but you'll also find the Montana resolution about their compact. Well worth going and finding out. It's a tab called DC v. Heller, GOA brief and other briefs and documents. In fact, we put together a catalog of probably all the good, bad, and ugly briefs that had been submitted on this case. It's probably around 50. It's a lot of briefs. A lot of lawyers were working on this. But I'm reasonably certain that ours were the only ones that took that particular tack and essentially took the same position, maybe a little bit more diplomatically, but took the same position as did the state of Montana. And so it's there. They're on notice. And, there wouldn't be the only reason that Montana might want to go knock on the door of Alberta right to their north and say, you guys got a lot of oil and we got some too, and you guys kind of like freedom, and we do too. We could probably do pretty well together, and I don't know that either one of us need the nuts back east. You know, I was on an airplane, a long trip, heading south, and there were a couple of folks that were, I guess, they were interested in what I'd been doing. I was working on my presentation that I gave down in Panama for to a gun group, and we got to talking, and boy, they sounded like they were they could have been members of Gun Owners of America, and they were really quite constitutionally oriented, would be a word I would use to describe their thinking. And then they told me they were Canadians, and I told them, I said, "Oh, well, you must be from Alberta." They said, "Yup, about 45 minutes north of Calgary." Yep.
Well, because we have some listeners up there.
They're doing very well with the folks from Montana, believe me.
Well, we have some of our listeners up there just north of Calgary, and I'll tell you, they're pretty much rugged individualists, and God bless them. Was that Ted Olson who actually worked on your, you said,
no,
Bob Olson?
It's another Olson. Bill Olson is a fellow who's done legal work for Gun Owners America for a long time, and he and Herb Titus is, what do they call it, of counsel or something like that to Bill Olson's firm, and they've been doing our gun work now for the last 2+ years and have become quite the experts in especially federal firearms law, and we've gotten involved as advisors in a number of key cases where there's litigation, especially at the federal level, BATF going against dealers and individuals, and these fellows have really gotten this law under their belt, and they've been able to provide some really critical advice to the attorney who's actually doing the courtroom work for these various folks, and we've also done some Friends of the Court briefs that they've been working on, and I'm really pleased with the way they have an eye for seeing, almost like chess players, moving, seeing where the pieces need to be down several moves away. For instance, we got involved in a Friend of the Court brief for a guy that I'm sure none of us would probably want to spend a whole lot of time with, and Mr. Watson had been arrested for selling some drugs, and he had been given a huge number of extra years in prison because the government had convicted him of having used a gun in the crime. Well, the use turned out to have been receipt of the gun in payment for the drugs. Now, you know, most people don't really think that's what using a gun in a crime means. We didn't either. And so we filed a Friend of the Court brief when this thing went up to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court ruled 9-0 that, no, they don't think using a gun in a crime means taking one as payment either. And that's pretty impressive because the Supreme Court all too often sides with the government. And when they go 9-0, that's a real rebuke.
Well, I think, of course, people have to understand that 1 out of every 32 American adults, 1 out of every 32 American adults is either in prison, probation, or parole. So maybe, of course, they want to cut back on the prison population. Of course, this whole thing is bankrupting America. The most rapidly growing industry in the United States today is prisons, building prisons, taking care of prisoners. And ladies and gentlemen, people say, we're a land of the free. Well, in communist China, where they have 4 times our population, they only have about 1.6 million people in prison. And why don't
underscore your point. There's a lady whose name escapes me, been in the news just recently. She had been incarcerated, or convicted anyway, of some kind of drug dealing when she was very young, I think either still a teenager or maybe in her very early 20s, and she hit it on the lam and disappeared. Now, 22 years later, she's somehow discovered, even unbeknownst to her husband, she had this background. She's living in an upscale neighborhood with 3 kids, and they want to put her in jail.
You know, Chris, basically, she had actually had escaped from prison. Was
that what it was? Okay.
But be that as it may, I mean, here she's 19 years old when, of course, she was convicted, and they gave her a 20-year period, period in jail, 10 to 20 years in jail, for dealing, for being associated with a drug ring. And, you know, 10 to 20 years for being associated with a drug ring, why, of course, we don't give that length of prison term to rapists in this country, and murderers. And, of course, people don't understand that there's something seriously wrong with our criminal justice system, but that's another subject.
Well, not yes and no. I brought up Mr. Watson and his, quote, using a gun in a crime, because I wanted to get to something that's even, in a way, more outrageous than this one-time 19-year-old maybe drug dealer. It probably wasn't even a dealer, just as you say, associated with. The two Border Patrol agents, Ramos and Compion, that were given 11 and 12-year sentences, 10 years of each of those sentences was for having fired a gun in the commission of a crime. You've probably already figured out where I'm going, because the firing the gun in a commission of a crime is not a federal offense. It's a sentencing enhancement, but it's not something you can get convicted on. Maybe having carried a gun in commission of a crime, and then if you fired it, you could get an extra 10 years, but it's not what you get convicted on. And the government pulled this little switcheroo in this case, and when we saw what came down from Watson, that the court seems to have a serious interest in making it so that sentences somehow fit what actually happened and not some clever prosecutorial imaginative use of their tools to really stick it to people and put them away for long periods of time so that the prison industry is a growth industry, as you were saying. Ramos and Compion got bit by that, and we figured if they'll do that to a couple of cops, God help the rest of us.
Amen to that. And of course, before we go on, I do want Larry to get out the address, web address, and how people can contact Gun Owners of America. I know you have a very tricky telephone number that people have a hard time forgetting. Why don't you tell people how they can get in touch with your organization?
Well, we would certainly like them to go to our website, but if they can't do that, I'll give out that phone number. It's toll-free. It's 888-88-6-GUNS, which is 888, and then 886, and then the letters, G-U-N-S. But hopefully folks can get on the web, go to gunowners.org, and that's where they will find the brief that we've been talking about for the D.C. case that we filed. They can find our friend of the court brief on U.S. v. Watson, and also U.S. v. Ramos and U.S. v. Compion. Those briefs that we've filed are there, and of perhaps particular interest would be the opportunity people have to really make a difference in what's happening in Washington by getting on our free email alert list, usually about weekly, sometimes not even that much. When the Congress is doing something that folks need to know about, we'll send out an alert, and then in that alert, we'll make it so they can send an email off to the appropriate person, their representative, their senators. Right now, the first thing they'll see at the very top of our page is an alert that we put out dealing with this poor pastor, U.S. pastor that's facing 3 years in a Russian pokey. Actually, it'll be in a gulag for the serious crime of having inadvertently not declared, because he couldn't figure out how to, that he had a box of hunting rounds that he intended to give to a Russian pastor as a thank you for having put him up the last time he had been in Russia. And we're urging people to send email to Condoleezza Rice and to George Bush, Secretary of State and the President, so that we know that they're apparently doing some things behind the scenes to try to get this guy out of Russia, but we don't want them to lose track of this this very important matter, and so we think it would be very helpful for them to know that the American people are watching. We want to see what kind of results they will get. We want to see them get results and get this guy out. And so while we're on the subject, let me just urge people to go to gunowners.org and hit that top alert, and send off some email. Just think of it this way. if it were you or somebody in your family that was in this predicament, looking at a little bit more than three years in a Russian gulag, I think you'd appreciate it too if your fellow Americans got behind you and did at least something like sending an email.
Amen to that. Well, I certainly want to endorse what Larry is doing. I've known him for some years. I've known, of course, the man who founded Gun Owners of America, Senator Bill Richardson. And so I certainly endorse what they're doing, and I can recommend them to you without hesitation. The material is good. It's the one gun owners organization I trust, and several out there have compromised on too many issues. We will not necessarily name them. We would not want to name the National Rifle Association, but certainly the Gun Owners of America is an organization you can put your confidence in. Larry's back there in Washington, D.C. They're doing a good job. They need your help. So that's Gun Owners of America, and certainly utilize their information. Well, let me point out that there is an effort all over the world to disarm the people, because, of course, there is an effort out there to create a world government. And in South Africa, where Larry's been, in Panama, in Costa Rica, here in the United States, in Australia, Canada, England, all throughout the world, they're trying to disarm the people. Is this happening by accident? I don't believe so for 1 minute. I believe there is an agenda, but they don't want you common folks out there in the audience to understand this is a coordinated effort to disarm the people of the world. What sort of reaction did you get when you went to South Africa?
Well, the last time I went, the purpose of the trip was to help some folks down there kick off Gun Owners of South Africa, which they very overtly were modeling on Gun Owners of America. They wanted a no-compromise group. They saw that the existing groups had been much more of the mindset of the National Rifle Association here and had been making nice, making concessions, and all that did was the same thing that it's ever done here, which was to maybe more slowly than otherwise, but nevertheless produced a constant loss, little by little, sometimes not quite so little, of their right to keep and bear arms in South Africa.
And let me just point out, I'm firmly convinced that most of our conservative and Christian organizations have been infiltrated, and of course thus neutralized and are simply surrendering our freedom. And you follow those leaders? I know this is true in organized medicine. People at the head of organized medicine were interested in not only destroying private practice medicine, and of course they also are not interested in helping people. They have another agenda, and the patients...
Yeah, they've been bought out by government money
sure
through
have.
The bureaucracy. And so in their case, I think it's very evident that there's been a real greed factor in what they've done. There's no question about it.
Well, let's get to South Africa. You were talking about what's going on down there. And so they're trying to set up a Gun Owners of South Africa so that both the blacks and the whites can keep their weapons. And there is an organized effort by the Marxist government there.
Yes.
That we brought to power, incidentally. Your State Department brought this Marxist government to power to disarm the people and, of course, to do in South Africa what they've done in Rhodesia. So what happened when you were there?
Well, we were delighted to see the amount of press attention that we got. I'm sure the government was beside itself that very left-wing media, and yet they were just so convinced that all they had to do was, I'm presuming, all they had to do was report on what we were saying, and people would say, oh, this is impossible. These people are loons. Because I mainly left this particular point in the hands of the South Africans, because I didn't want a foreigner saying what they were saying, but they were saying, don't obey the law.
And that was, of course, the blacks were out there. The blacks who had guns, they don't want to give them up because they realize, of course, that the government there cannot
absolutely
be trusted. The black government is a Marxist government that wants to enslave both the black and the white, and of course, we can thank the American State Department for that. But anyway, of course, what's really so interesting is the blacks wanted the whites to join with them, and eventually
yes,
they did, didn't they?
They did. That was the most exciting thing. My last night there, I addressed a crowd of mostly Afrikaners, white Afrikaners, in an area very close to Cape Town, and a man had come over from Soweto, a Zulu, and he addressed that crowd, and he challenged them to join with us, the blacks, in civil disobedience to the government so that we would keep our guns and be able to protect our families.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. Okay, go right ahead, Larry.
And this man exhorting for civil disobedience and to join with the blacks, and here are these Afrikaners who had been the pillars of apartheid a few years before, absolutely cheering out of their mind. They thought this guy was absolutely the, you know, I'm glad I didn't have to speak after he did, because it would have been pretty anticlimactic. They just couldn't get enough of this guy. And I thought, you know what? I have seen something I wasn't sure I would ever see, certainly in South Africa, and I think there's hope. And indeed, the South African government has been saying, well, you know those renewal dates beyond which we're coming to collect your guns? We were having trouble administering the law, and there's a delay. We're going to have a delay in when the final renewal date is. By the way, the renewal is a bunch of poppycock, because if you apply for the renewal, they will not give you a renewal. You will then have identified yourself as someone, and they'll come and get your gun. That's all they're doing. And so people decide, well, I'm not going to make it that easy for them. We're just not going to comply at all. And there has been massive civil disobedience, and so the government has been forced to back and fill for at least for a while. And I'm very delighted that I had a minor role to play in what those folks are doing down there, because they're the one. You know, I leave town, there ain't no problem for me. But those guys have to stay there, have to live there, and increasing power outages and all the other joys of living in a socialist country, and they are looking the beast in the eye, and they're not blinking. And I can't tell you how much I admire those people.
Well, they're wonderful people. I lived among them for 3 years. I lived in Bloemfontein there in the mid-1970s, and they would have done away with apartheid. This was the goal. I mean, they were working to do away with it as quickly as they could, but the leaders in Washington, D.C., they didn't want a peaceful solution. They wanted to bring a Marxist communist government, pro-Castro, pro-Russian, pro-Chinese communist government to power. And the leaders in Washington, D.C. did that. At least they're one thing. They're always consistent. They
and
never
put
anything for their freedom. Hey, we're out of time, Larry. I guess it's been Larry
Pratt. Have to pick up on it in the future. Thanks so much, Dan.
Hey, I hope I can get you on again sometime real soon.
Very good. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Good night. Thanks. God bless. All right, fine. That was Larry Pratt, Gun Owners of America, doing a great job, and we certainly recommend their ministry, their work to you, because I think that they are exemplary. I wish that every organization, every conservative organization, were as trustworthy and straightforward as Gun Owners of America. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here, and of course there is a worldwide movement to disarm the people, as there is a worldwide movement to bring about a one-world government, a one-world religion, and install a one-world leader. How is this happening? Who is coordinating? And am I suggesting that there's a conspiracy? Of course I am. And I'm simply quoting what they say. They say, and I'm speaking now of the writings you'll find up there on the Lucis Trust, used to be the Lucifer Publishing House, but it's the Lucis Trust now, with offices in Sydney, in New York, in Geneva, Switzerland, in London, financed by some of the wealthiest people in the world, according to their websites. And they have their front organizations, just like the communists do, the New Group of World Servers, and a couple of other organizations. But the New Group of World Servers is the one where, of course, one of the wealthiest men, one of the wealthiest two men in America, is listed as one of their sponsors. So understand, ladies and gentlemen, that there are people out here who have a different worldview. They want to destroy freedom. They want to destroy America. In fact, they want to bring the whole world under international control. And that's why they're using the financial and military power of the United States to establish a world empire, which ultimately would be taken over by the ruling elite. And that's why America has troops in 130 nations of the world. This is why we have over 720 bases throughout the world. This is why we spend more money on our military than all the rest of the nations of the world put together. Why would you do that? Why? Very simply. Because the people who really control America, and believe me, it's not George Bush or Dick Cheney, they're simply fronts for the power elite, or what I call the Brotherhood of Darkness, or they call, the people on the other side, call the spiritual hierarchy, the Ancients of Wisdom, the Elder Brothers. And you can read their writings, and of course, if you simply give us a call, and you'd like to get my talk on the planned police state, and you need to get the syllabus that goes with that. You'll actually get the writings from these people, and of course, specifically request, we'll send it to you free of charge, the pamphlet that's put out by the people from the dark side, those who worship the Prince of Darkness. The one on the working of the spiritual hierarchy, we'll be glad to send it to you free of charge, or if you get anything else, you need to get my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. You need to get my talk on the forbidden secret. And, of course, you could need to get the 4-tape set on the supernatural, because there is another dimension, and you can't understand anything going on today unless you understand that dimension. There's a 4-tape set on the spiritual dimension, and a book we recommend with that called The Beautiful Side of Evil, written by Johanna Michelson, who was a medium, who was actually involved in the occult. And actually, she was being trained to become a spiritual healer, and she saw hundreds of miraculous supernatural healings, and she thought it was from God. Only later did she realize that these were demonic manifestations. So then, of course, we have the book entitled Hostage to the Devil, written by Father Malachi Martin, a Jesuit priest, and the 4-tape set that goes with that, entitled The it's called The Wisdom of Malachi Martin, The Wisdom of Malachi Martin. We have a book called Satanic Crimes, and a 4-tape set that goes with that. It goes into the Bilderbergers, one of the most powerful organizations in the world today. And everybody in Europe knows about the Bilderbergers, but they don't want you to know, so it's never mentioned in your newspapers here. You can go up on the Internet and read about it. I think there were 2 articles in the newspapers last year, and that was all. Because, you see, they control the media. Ultimately, they control what the people think. We have a great DVD on the Bilderbergers put out by Alex Jones called Endgame. We have actually 3 books on the Bilderbergers. The Bilderbergers by Daniel Estulin. We have The Bilderberger Diary by James Tucker, and then we have Satanic Crimes. Our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927, our webpage, radioliberty.com. You can go there, you can listen to our radio programs live 4 hours a day. You can listen to our archive programs, you can listen to our the MP3 programs. You can listen to our feed through the satellite 9 hours a day. And then, of course, we ask you to pray for America, to pray for revival, to pray for our leaders and ministers, but please pray for Radio Liberty, for provision and protection. This is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views. And, well, for this next hour, they're going to be the views of Barry Shamish, who's a Jewish patriot. He certainly is very concerned about what's happening to Israel. He was very well known in Israel. He had written extensively on the murder of the of Yitzhak Rabin, who was the prime minister of Israel, and had convinced almost half of the religious Jews in Israel that there was a conspiracy behind the murder of Rabin. And, of course, it involved the Shabbat, which is their counterpart of the FBI, Secret Service here. But, of course, there came a time when he was ruffling too many feathers, and because of threats on his life, he had to come to the United States, where he lives, and we're privileged to have him on our program, all of our programs here. Now, I want to point out that Barry Shamish is going to be speaking at this conspiracy conference, and that's going to be at the 7th and 8th of June. It's just a little over a month away at the Marriott Hotel in the Santa Clara area, along with a lot of our good friends, Jim Mars, of course, Joyce Riley will be there, and certainly a number of other key people who, and we'll have a list, and we'll be telling you more about that, but you might start thinking about it. It's going to be the 6th and 7th of June at the Marriott Hotel in Santa Clara, and if you're in the area, it'll be well worthwhile, and you'll get a chance to meet and talk to Barry Shamish, who'll be one of the featured speakers. Barry, it's so good to have you with us again tonight.
Yeah, interesting start. I was on a Santa Clara afternoon radio show today. Boy, did they not know what I was talking about. Let's put it this way. When I speak there, it appears I'll have a virgin audience, if this radio show is any indication. But yeah, I'm looking forward to it as well.
Well, basically, of course, they get people from all over the country coming to the conspiracy conference. We've been, of course, going there for a number of years. We've spoken on a couple of occasions, and I think probably I'll be speaking there next month. But I think they have the best lineup I've ever seen. Usually they have a lot of people all dressed in black, you know, wearing satanic rings and satanic emblems. But this year they've got some excellent speakers, and I'm really so pleased to see you on the lineup. But you'll have a good audience. That's a conspiracy conference, the 7th and 8th of June. Pardon me, the 6th and
no, you're right.
7th and 8th of June, and it's at the Marriott Hotel, and we'll be putting out the telephone number for contacts. Go ahead, Barry.
All right, well, I'll talk about what I always talk about, which seems to be unknown to the people behind this conference. We'll talk about, first of all, really the biggest stories that are utterly unreported in the United States, and the biggest one is I think it's the biggest one, but there's another one that's coming up as well, water, we'll talk about that as well, the IDF, the Israel Defense Forces, made a stunning announcement at the beginning of this week, really a stunning announcement, that they're giving up, the Israeli army is giving up the security, the detail, the actual security of for 40 towns in Judea and Samaria. They're hiring private security firms. They're giving up, why are you paying taxes? I mean, really, this is what an army is for, is to provide security. But they're not going to do it anymore.
Hold that thought. We're going to be back in just a moment with Barry, and they're going to leave those settlers there to be guarded by Retikovs. We'll be right back. Go right ahead, Barry.
Oh, quick commercial. Retikovs. Now, look, in the middle of a genuine conflagration, an outright war, these little Retikovs with their phony police uniforms and maybe a revolver, if they're lucky, are not going to be able to defend these towns. And these are big towns. They're leaving Kiryat Arba without the army.
That is the main settlement of Hebron. It's about half a mile up the hill from Hebron. It's Kiryat Arba. No longer has the army guarding it. Well, that... Just try and imagine your Secretary of Defense making a major announcement that the army will no longer be in Iraq. We're hiring a private security firm to take over the duties there. No difference. That's exactly what the army announced.
Now, can I even have a better analogy? Why don't we announce that we're going to disband the American Army, the Air Force, and the Marine Corps, and the Navy, and we're simply going to hire professional guards to protect our country? Would people say that would be insane? And that's what they're doing to the settlers in Judea, Samaria, and of course the residents of Hebron, the Jewish residents. They're leaving them there to be slaughtered. Why would they do something like that?
Well, you've got the Allied Security Corporation watching them now. Why? Because this is the expulsion. This is, well, look, it's known as the Gaza Plan of Daniel Pipes. Daniel Pipes had this marvelous suggestion, a month and a half before they pulled the Jews out of Gush Katif. He said, well, just pull the army back and see how they like it, defend themselves without the army. Just pull the army out of Gush Katif. And Daniel Pipes, of course, is at the Council on Foreign Relations, a major, major executive. They run his so-called Middle East Forum. They pay for it. They pay for his lousy magazine. It's all CFR. And Daniel Pipes offered the suggestion that's now being put into practice. You take the army out. That's the Pipes plan. Now, but it's worse. 10 communities in Judea and Samaria don't even have the rent-a-cops. They're thoroughly undefended. The army is simply pulling out. And what they will do, what these people will do, is anybody's guess.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment with Barry Sarris. All right, fine. And Chris Barry is pointing out that, of course, although they have rent-a-cops for most of the settlements there in Judea and Samaria, 10 of them will not have any protection at all. Now, you have to understand that there is an intense hatred of the Arabs for the Israelis, and if they show any sign of weakness, they've taken advantage of that. Suddenly, Israel pulled out of Gush Katif, they pulled out of Gaza, and what happened, after suddenly saying, we want peace, we're going to give you land, why, of course, they used Gaza then as a base for launching both mortar shells and rocket shells into Israel. And, of course, they intend to kill all of the Jews. That's really the ultimate goal of the Palestinians. And, of course, unfortunately, now you're going to leave settlements surrounded by Arab settlements, Jewish settlements surrounded by Arab settlements. We are arming the Arabs. Actually, we're certainly arming the Palestinian terrorists. Why would you do something like that? We're training them over in Jordan in all sorts of military activities. Why would you train the Palestinian terrorists? Well, of course, they're the good terrorists. They're not like those bad Hamas terrorists. These are the good terrorists. And then you're going to leave the Jewish settlements unguarded? What sort of madness is that, or is it something far more diabolical?
Well, actually, one misstatement. For some reason, the Israelis don't have a deep hatred towards the Arabs. It's the Arabs who have it towards the Jews. And go figure that one out, but Israelis are remarkably unhateful. That's a fit subject for another discussion, but, that's a fact. You don't hear a lot of anti-Arab hatred out of Israelis.
We have never heard the Israelis say we want to wipe every Arab off the face of the earth.
No, nothing like that. That's one of the weaknesses. The Israelis are very civilized. But, again, that's psychology. That's for another discusser of the situation. I'm just doing what they're planning. Now, when they made this announcement, I received several email summaries of the last month, what the IDF has done in the last month to do the pipes plan, really the evacuation of Judea and Samaria. The following programs have been canceled in the last month alone. The evacuation, of course, is now in full flight. Number one, it's called the Mitzar program. That's where the army worked with the settlements in case of the war, any war, a breakout of any hostilities. The settlements would fight on their own until the army could rescue them. And for this, they had weapons caches. They're all gone. All the weapons are being collected from the communities in Judea and Samaria. The Mitzar program is over. There is no army in case of a war without the Mitzar program. Gone. Next, they used to give serious subsidies for residents of Judea and Samaria to reinforce their car windows. And this is very important. There are a lot of incidents of stone throwing and rock throwing and any projectile throwing at passing cars. And the reason there aren't many casualties is because the cars are reinforced. Well, and it costs a lot to reinforce cars, a few thousand bucks to fix your windows up. That's gone. That program for reinforcing car windows has been canceled. Now, next, this is just cruel, what they've canceled. Just cruel. There are buses that take handicapped and retarded children to school. And the government protected these buses because, well, they're not only children. They're children who can't defend themselves under any circumstance. Healthy children are not the world's greatest soldiers, but at least in their own little way they can defend themselves if they have to. No matter how pathetically, these little kids cannot defend themselves at all. So they were given protection. Well, it's gone. No more protection against attacks on handicapped children's school buses. And that's just cruel. If you're a parent, and you're sending your little, well, I mean, there's endless handicaps. And you put them on a bus and expect the bus will be protected while they go to school. And while they're coming back, gone. And even that is being taken away from the Jewish residents of Judea and Samaria. And it's a cruel, cruel thing to do. But the IDF has canceled the protection of school buses for the handicapped. And now, one that affects, it used to affect me, in my heart of hearts, someday I hope it affects me again, but nonetheless, no more budget for settlement security vehicles. Now this, is just part of the day-to-day life of Judea and Samaria. Now, what I did, I gave a lot of lectures, in Judea and Samaria, and there were some settlements that were just so dangerous to get to. You'd have to go through very hostile Arab towns, and to get to the settlements, it was quite dangerous. So what I would do is I would park my car at a roadblock, and cell phone, or they would meet me, or we would cell phone the town I was going to, and they would pick me up in a reinforced car. Now, what that meant, it would usually be a pickup truck, but the windows would be very thick against any kind of attack of projectiles. In the passenger seat, there'd be someone with an automatic rifle. There would be radio control, always radio control. So if you were ambushed or set up in some way, within minutes you would have several armed vehicles surrounding you. This was essential to get to my lectures. My lectures would end at 2 a.m, and it was just a scary thing to drive through these Arab towns where they can arrange a flat tire for you with ease and a few spikes in the road. And then you're stuck in one of these towns where you'll be lynched. all these vehicles kept, well, they kept me at work. You know, I have friends, including an ex-wife who thought I was absolutely nuts to go to these obscure places, Tapuok and Sanur and very dangerous places. And I told them, I said, it's my work. What are you supposed to do? I mean, this is what I do. And without the settlement protection, without the vehicles, I would think twice about taking my flimsy car down these roads. It's all gone. And that means people who would normally come to the settlements to make repairs, utilities, deliver the groceries to the local store, they're not going to come. If they don't have a convoy to take them there in safety, they're not going to show up. What the Army has done has literally choked. It's choked. It's just choked the communities of Judea and Samaria. And they took the final screw and they turned it early this week, announcing that they're pulling out of 40 towns, including Kiryat Arba. I can't stress that enough. And there's going to be, instead of Jewish soldiers, you're going to have rent-a-guards.
But don't you think, DeBerry, this is all part of the program to force the people into settlements to leave? In other words,
that's the pipes plan.
That's what it's really all about, is to force the people to give up their homes. Are they going to be compensated for their homes when they give them up?
No, why should they be?
Well,
they didn't compensate anyone from Gush Katif.
Didn't they promise?
Living in what they call chata villas. Mobile homes. I doubt if they were even ever mobile. They're just shells. They're living in shells 2 years after the two is coming up now. It's been two and a half.
And I think what people have to understand is these were successful, wealthy, well-to-do people. Most of them, they had very successful farms down there. They had an ideal situation to live in. They were betrayed by the American State Department that forced Israel to turn Gaza over to the Palestinian terrorists. And now they're going to turn Judea and Samaria over to the Palestinian terrorists. And people don't understand that this is a 30-minute automobile drive from Tel Aviv. It's right in the heart of Israel, and you destroy the Jewish settlements there. Why, of course, you turn, of course, really the central part of Israel over to the Palestinian terrorists. Why would the American government want that? But then, of course, there are many things the American government does that just don't make any logical sense. Go right
ahead.
Well,
yes, the settlements, of course, if you know Israel, they're the spine of Israel. They're high hills that overlook Netanya and Herzliya and Tel Aviv. You see them all from what is called the West Bank, and you give them up, and, of course, the Arabs have within easy striking distance of the coast of Israel. That's a given. It's to break Israel's back is what's going on. Now, we have a couple of examples of this, and one is Tony Blair, and my Lord, I wish him only the worst. He is the negotiator it's the roadblock. They call it the road map now. Okay, should be the roadblock. It's Oslo. That's what it is. It's the quartet. Whatever the name is this week, Tony Blair is the former Prime Minister of England, is now the negotiator living in Israel. And I don't know if this was a leak or not a leak, but it came out that he ordered Ehud Barak, Israel's corrupt and crooked Minister of Defense, to dismantle key roadblocks. Now, I hear the music.
And you do, and of course people must understand the Oslo, that's the Oslo Accord. There is a plan. It's put together by, of course, the Council on Foreign Relations, which runs our State Department, to destroy Israel. When you understand that, everything makes sense. But the question is, what's the spiritual significance of what's going on? And we'll be back in just a moment with Barry Shamish. Barry, go right ahead.
Well, Barak sat down with Blair and heard the bad news. He has to dismantle new roadblocks. Now, he agreed to one that's just a beauty. There was a roadblock that separated Jenin from Nablus. Both these towns are in northern Samaria, and there was a roadblock between them. Well, what it was there for was to prevent explosives from reaching Jenin from Nablus, or Nablus from Jenin, or all the little towns in between. It was a very high security roadblock. It's gone. It's gone. It's all over with. But what's a little more surprising, and maybe this is the reason for the leak, I don't know, Blair asked Barack to dismantle the Beit El roadblock. Now, Beit El is, well, it's a suburb of Ramallah. I mean, you get to a junction, you get to the Beit El junction, you turn right, and you're inside a town of 3,000, a Jewish town, called Beit El. There's a Beit El, A and B, and a very large military base. And to the left, well, it's Nablus. And they're all within walking distance, 5 minutes, 10 minutes from each other. This roadblock is essential for keeping the last of Judea and Samaria guarded with this roadblock.
Now, is Nablus an Arab town?
No, it's Ramallah.
All right, fine.
It's Ramallah. I don't think I said Nablus.
No, I mean, okay, fine. Ramallah is Jewish or Arab?
Arab is their
okay,
capital.
Fine. Okay, go right ahead.
It's where the where Abbas keeps his home, and their so-called parliament exists there. Ramallah is the biggest city in the West Bank. Well, actually, Hebron, it's one, number one or two. It's a big one. And Blair asked Barack to dismantle the Ramallah Beit El roadblock, and this he couldn't do. I mean, nobody could do a thing like that. How? I don't know if there's an analogy. I guess just open the border, bring down the fence and open the border to Mexico. I guess that's the analogy. Well, Barack refused that one, but he accepted the Nablus to Jenin roadblock is gone, and the terrorism that will result from this, well, the war that will result from this will be felt shortly. And now there's another issue that's all connected, and we'll get to it shortly. That's the American government revealed, exposed, that Israel hit the Syrian nuclear plant a few months ago. Israel had a major operation and destroyed something, but Israel officially kept its mouth shut. There were leaks, that's for sure, but officially they didn't want to humiliate Syria. Arabs get very upset when they're defeated, and Menachem Begin blew out Iraq's Osirik nuclear reactor, and well, it wasn't long before Saddam Hussein was launching scuds against Israel. And if you ask me, the reason American troops, at least in part, went into Iraq.
Hold that thought. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and certainly Barry's been telling us how the American State Department, and apparently Tony Blair, who of course is part of this Anglo-American establishment, part of this elite who runs America and Great Britain, Tony Blair had forced Barack, who is the Israeli defense minister, to take down at least one of the major roadblocks there, which will allow, of course, the Arab terrorists to bring explosives in and kill a lot of Jews. There was one, of course, roadblock that Blair wanted Barack to take down, and Barack wouldn't do it, which would allowed the people in Ramallah, an Arab town, to invade a Jewish town and kill the terrorists there, kill the people there. I mean, it's a very, very short distance, a few miles apart. There is a roadblock to protect the Jewish settlers, and, of course, Tony Blair does not want them protected. What Tony Blair and the people who control the Council on Foreign Relations, what I call the Brotherhood of Darkness, really want to destroy Israel. Now, go ahead, pick up the story there.
Oh, it's not a few miles. I mean, it's a few feet. You look to your right, there's the Jewish town of Beit El, and you walk 20 feet to the other direction, you're in Ramallah. This is a very sensitive junction. But nonetheless, for the time being, Barack said no. He'll say yes eventually. But back to the Syrian nuclear attack, why is the United States irritating the situation by officially, all right, officially announcing that Israel knocked out a nuclear facility in Syria? We don't know. Israel keeps tight-lipped about enough things, but it's rare that it actually works. In this case, nobody knew the actual truth until the Americans exposed it this week. Now, I read through the American, report, details, whatever got to the media early this week. Now, one fact stood up. Condoleezza Rice, a real Jew-hating, I can't use swear terms, but for her, she deserves it.
No, just don't use them. Go ahead.
I'm not going to use them. I know the rules here. She objected. And she objected to Israel knocking out a nuclear facility. And you have to wonder, I mean, look, if any reason that American troops are losing their lives in Iraq, it's to prevent weapons of mass destruction supposedly from spreading throughout the world. That's what they told us. Well, it didn't matter to Rice. She objected to Israel knocking out Syria's nuclear facility. And go figure that one out. Just a little point. And now it's leading to something. And that is what, we call them neocons. But I'm going to talk about one shocking lecture that was in Jerusalem that I attended. I was invited to attend. It was John Loftus. He wrote a few books that are highly admired by the anti-New World Order Israeli crowd. One with his partner Mark Aaron's The Secret War Against the Jews brought, well, a huge crowd to hear John Loftus speak. Now, he spoke at really my stomping grounds. That's the Root and Branch Society in Jerusalem, where I would get like the biggest crowds, and they were never more than 100, and I would get them 50 to 75. Not all that many people go to a lecture, and that was considered very good. He had them around the block. I never waited in line to go to a speech before. There must have been 300 people there. The room was jammed. Now, I was there. I was invited by Arya Gallen. He runs the Root and Branch Society. He asked me to bring some books and present it to John Loftus, who, by the way, is on my email list, has been for many years, and he's an executive. He's on the board of Root and Branch. Everyone was expecting a very important speech. And, well, were we shocked. But on the bright side, at least we got the New World Order Middle East plan from someone who's involved in it. Now, Loftus's book and what he spoke about was really against the oil cartel who were plotting against Israel. And it begins, of course, with John D. Rockefeller, and then the Dulles brothers, Alan and John Foster, and then it swirls out in another direction.
Of course, they're all members of the Council on Foreign Relations, but what's really so interesting is what happened when Barry asked John Loftus about the Council on Foreign Relations, and we'll get to that in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. All right, Barry, you go ahead and pick the story up.
Well, okay, let's pop over. I asked John Loftus. I said every person who you've been condemning for their conniving and sneakery are not only founders of the Council on Foreign Relations, which is the case with J.D. Rockefeller, but are all members of the executive of the Council on Foreign Relations. So I said to him, why don't you just call them what they are, executives of the Council on Foreign Relations? I mean, this is not such a big organization. When he was there, it had fewer than 4,000 members. I said, this is no coincidence. And he got all flustered and all flushed, and he says that it has nothing to do with the CFR. And he says, and anyone who thinks it does, he called them nuts. All right? Anti-CFR nuts. And I was taken aback by this asinine comment. Again, if you're writing a book against Rockefeller, Dulles, and the oil cabal, you have to mention the CFR, because that's what they belong to. That's who organized them. But he did something very different. He said that the younger Bush has nothing to do with his father, nothing to do with Prescott Bush, his grandfather, not to mention his great-grandfather, Samuel Bush. Nothing. He doesn't even take advice from his father. He's a different person altogether. And look, I mean, you'd want to talk nonsense. That's the ultimate in nonsense. The fact that his grandfather was a CFR founder in 1922 has nothing to do with the younger Bush in power today. And then he said, and now I'm furious. And by the way, I'm sitting with people who know what this New World Order business is. Next to me was Gemma Bleck. She's the photographer for my book, Bye Bye Gaza. I turned to her and I said, do you believe what this man is saying right now? He said, he's backing the Bush regime and everything they're doing. And by the way, Bush had just attacked Iraq, and shocking to most Israelis, we were not in favor of this attack. But then he says something that turns most of the audience against him. He says, I
want you to hold that, because we're going to bring our stations back on board, and I want them to hear what you're about to say, so I already know. Well, hold on just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. He's talking about a talk that was given by John Loftus, who wrote the book, The Secret War Against the Jews. And, of course, the book accuses the oil cartel, John D. Rockefeller, Alan Dulles, John Foster Dulles, all members of the Council on Foreign Relations are being part of this this war against the Jews. And so Barry Shamish gets up and says, why don't you talk about the Council on Foreign Relations? And Loftus gets very flustered and angry. He's, of course, the speaker. And he says the Council on Foreign Relations is a great organization. Anybody who doesn't believe that is nuts. And, of course, nobody ever talks about the fact it's a front for a secret society, and that's another subject. But then, of course, he comes out, John Loftus comes out in favor of George Bush and everything he's doing and what a wonderful person he is and how he has no relationship to his father. It's just by coincidence that his father had been a previous president of the United States 8 years previously before George W. was elected. But then... then, of course, the most important part of this subject comes up. So you pick up the story there. What does Loftus say about the ultimate plan for what this is all about?
Well, recall he also got a job at Fox TV as a commentator. He was privy to whatever this plan the Americans were up to in Iraq was all about. And apparently he knew. He tells the audience, don't retaliate. It's not up to Israel to get involved. And people in the audience got very flustered and noted that up to the time, from the signing of Oslo till that day, there were over 2,000 Israeli casualties since Oslo. And he says, that's not too many. What are you complaining about? Now, 2,000 casualties in a 5.5 million Jews is plenty. It's an atrocity, and he says, don't retaliate. Then he says, he gives the whole picture. He says, leave Syria to us. He says, no matter what Syria does to Israel, it's none of your business. Leave Syria to us, he said. he says that Iraq buried its weapons of mass destruction there. And then he tells his cockamamie story how Saddam Hussein put all the weapons of mass destruction on trucks, and he took them out at night so the satellites couldn't see them. And by the way, satellites can see at night today. They have nighttime vision. But neither here nor there, that's what he said, that Saddam Hussein buried his weapons of mass destruction in the Bekaa Valley. And that's why the UN can't find any, because they're in Syria. And he promises that we're going to go into Syria and we're going to find those weapons. Next act, he's got the American army attacking Syria. And then here's the tour de force. And he says, after Syria, we will sweep through Iran.
And I think, ladies and gentlemen, that is probably the most important thing you're going to learn tonight. There is a master plan, and of course it involves an attack on Iran, an attack on Syria, and completing the destruction of the axis of evil. Understand, ladies and gentlemen, that we, of course, had brought the mullahs to power in Iran back in 1979. Everybody's forgotten that we toppled the Shah of Iran, and we brought the mullahs to power. Ahmadinejad looks like he came from central casting someplace. He's playing a part. But the ultimate plan is America's war with Iran. Would that be a fair summary of America's coming war with Iran and Syria? Was that what he was talking about?
Well, that's what Loftus was claiming. Don't worry, don't retaliate, we're going to take care of everything. We're going to sweep through Syria, we're going to, well, ultimately that means Lebanon too, and we're going to sweep through Iran, and all of this apparently is what these madmen were actually thinking of. They were going to knock down countries one by one and without Israel. And this apparently is really what they were planning. Okay, I want to add that. This is what they were planning.
And I think they're still planning.
Unless anyone thinks that Loftus is pro-Jewish, pro-Israel, just be very happy no matter what you think of your soldiers in Iraq, and who they are and how they're taken from prison and put into the army and what you do without a draft and the kind of soldiers you get. If it wasn't for the Arabs fighting back, they would have done it. This is what they were planning to do. But it looks like they ran into a little too much resistance and didn't do it. But this is what they were thinking, the year 2003, and Loftus gave it away to us. And what a world that, what a mess that would have been. Nonetheless, I'm going to switch topics.
All right, before you do, Barry, I want you to go ahead and get your site out, your website, how people can get your books, how people can get your DVDs, and then we'll go to the next subject. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's a beaut, another huge subject this week. Well, you get my books by going to lulu.com. You write www.lulu.com. In the right-hand corner, it says search. Write in my name, Chamish. That's Chamish, and you'll get to my books. I would suggest you have a look at them. They're not expensive, and they're delivered to your house that week. The website, you can now just go to barrychamish.com, and you'll get there. And for the DVDs, my latest is called Take Back Israel, which may be irrelevant. I had a good plan, but everything is out of control now. Nonetheless, it was professionally filmed in New York a couple of months ago, and that's my latest. I have others. Phone me for that. It's not on Lulu. And that's 904-501-7605. That's 904-501-7605. And now something we can look forward to this week that is, again, so devastating. The Kinneret, that is the Sea of Galilee, is going to reach, at the end of this July, according to all predictions, the Kinneret, for the first time in its history, and I mean a history of millennia, is going to reach the black line. Now, the Kinneret, the water supply, there were two red lines, higher and lower. the black line was the end, because when you reach the black line, the pipes that pump the water out to 70% of Israel, by the way, 70% of the water comes out of this lake, are now above water, and that's it. You can't pump anymore. They expect that to be in late July. Now, the excuses given are we had a dry winter after several dry winters, and we had we're in the middle of a drought, in other words, and that's just nonsense. Israel had quite a rainy winter, lots of snow, two major snowstorms. What people don't understand is what I wrote about the Kinneret, because I interviewed the man negotiating the peace, the water treaty with Jordan in 1994. I was working for the Gemini News Service in London. I did about 20 articles for them. They were an offbeat news service, went throughout the Third World, also parts of America. They actually did a pretty good service. Now, working for Gemini, I was, let's just put it this way. I met someone who could help me an awful lot, get a great story. I served in the Army with Yaakov Tzemach, younger than I, very, very smart guy. He had a good sense of humor. I liked him a lot. We were friends, and he was the assistant to the water negotiators, to the water negotiator. He worked for the water company of Israel. It's called Tahal. And however I met Yaakov, I believe I phoned him up, and I was shocked to get him on the line. I don't remember the exact details, but Yaakov did the impossible then. He got me an exclusive interview with the man negotiating with the Jordanians over the water issue. I don't have the man's name because I promised him I wouldn't use his name. I would just call him the negotiator. I wrote an article. It was called Giving Away Dream Water, because that's what he told me they were doing. Now, I've analyzed why people told me remarkable things that didn't make the Israeli media. And I figure it's not because of my charm or they like me a lot. It's because I asked the right questions, and the rest of the media was bought and sold. They were selling peace, and nobody asked the right questions. We met at a restaurant in Tel Aviv, and he drank a little too much and became very sentimental. I wouldn't even use that word. He became sad. That's what he became. At first, he did the usual interview stuff. He pulls out the graphs and the amount of water, and this winter and that one, this year and that. And I looked at the graphs, and I see after peace treaty, the Kinneret is not having a really blue winter. Blue was water, and there was a line, and it was the surface of the Kinneret, and suddenly I see it starts dropping. And I asked him, why is it dropping? And his whole attitude changed. And he said to me, I hope our leaders know what they're doing. He says, I really hope they are, because if I'm wrong, the Kinneret within 20 years will dry up. And I said, what? Why would it dry up? He says, we're going to give away free of charge to the Jordanians 50 million cubic meters of water every year.
And because what we're really talking about is the Sea of Galilee being drawn up. I mean, it's a beautiful spot. It's the major source of Israel's water. And what they're doing is intensively giving away so much water that it's simply going to destroy the Sea of Galilee. And then what will Israel do? Well, as of July, there won't be any more water from the Sea of Galilee, if what Barry says is true. Because, of course, the level of the lake will have dropped below the black line. So pick up the story.
Well, he says, first of all, he says to me, 50 million cubic meters may not sound like a lot to you. In fact, it sounded like plenty to me. But he said, every year, if you take away 50 million this year, provided we replenish the lake next year, it isn't such a tragedy. But he says, compounded over the years, 50 million cubic meters of water every single year. He says that lake is going to dry up. And then he started telling me the government's plans. And this our foreign minister, Shimon Peres, was in charge of, even though it was Rabin who signed the peace treaty with Hussein of Jordan. It was Peres negotiating the economic side to this treaty. And he says, we're trying to find water. They told me to find 50 million cubic meters of water. And he says, I'm looking everywhere for the water. We're going to, there's brackish waters from streams along the edge of the Kinneret. We're going to throw that into the mixture. And he says, we're going to dam the Yarmouk. It's a river that flows into the Kinneret from the east. And he says that'll give us spare water we never had, but it should have gone into the lake anyways. And he says, he lifts his head and says, I'm giving away dream water. And that became the title of my article, that in order to get a peace with Jordan, they gave away water Israel couldn't afford to give away. It's an ecological nightmare to give away 50 million cubic meters to Jordan free of charge. It's not Jordan's lake. There was no reason to do this except Jordan is a desert kingdom with not enough water, and for Israel to get them to sign some sort of peace treaty, they gave away our lake. The lake is going to dry up. And the man, as I said, he became extremely agitated. And he told me the truth. He said, within 20 years, I think that lake is going to disappear. And he's, what can I tell you? Come July, you're going to find out that Israel no longer has its major source of water. And by the way, the aquifers in Israel are so polluted from the, and by the way, a lot of it, an awful lot of it, is from bringing the PLO back. They're sapping the aquifers dry. Israel is going to have almost no water by the end of July this year. And it was not because of a drought. And I've got people telling me that the Bible promised a drought and this is nonsense. This is man-made. The Kinneret never dried up before. In July, you're going to see it dried up. And now, there's a little bit of a talk where I think we had an influence. Shall we go on to Benami Kaddish?
You go right ahead.
Well, we did, for people who don't know, the American government arrested an 84-year-old octogenarian named Benami Kaddish, right from his old age home. He was living in a retirement home in New Jersey. At 84, he was not the best of health for natural causes. They took him to New York and arrested him for espionage. Apparently, here's the story. Apparently, way back in 1985, when Jonathan Pollard was spying for Israel. Benami Kaddish was working for the U.S. Army Research Arsenal, and he transferred 50 to 100 documents, and the big hint is, to Pollard's handler. Now look, guys, you don't arrest someone 23 years after his crime. That is absolutely absurd. 23 years later, they arrest him. What's he going to do, pass on more sensitive documents? He's living in a retirement home. But they did. Now, the Israeli analysis has been so flawed and silly, and it exposes more the egoism of the writers than reality. They're trying to figure out why America arrested this guy and charged him with espionage. Now, everyone agrees that this is going to make the release of Jonathan Pollard impossible. Well, he wasn't working alone. I mean, here come the arguments. But nobody understands why the Americans did it. I mean, some of the analysis is just hilarious. Bush is coming to Israel for the 60th anniversary. He wants a peace deal. This is pressuring Israel. Israel could care less if an 84-year-old guy is arrested for espionage. And Bush is not coming there for the birthday. He's coming there for the most dastardly reasons possible. But neither here nor there, I believe the reason was us, and I'm not joking about this. I'm not saying it. I'm saying it very seriously.
Hold on to where this has been. Barry Sammons here at Radio Liberty.
Too bad.
Okay, Barry, go ahead. Finish up your thoughts.
How much time do we have?
We got 3 minutes.
We did a show 3 weeks ago where finally I explained that Jonathan Pollard's information was used by Shimon Peres and it became Iran-Contra. I explained how Pollard's information about arms for hostages was expanded to include arms, Israeli arms for Iranian hostages to buy Israeli cocaine in Central America and just turned arms for hostages into an international mafia. And Pollard was unknowingly, was the source of the information. And then I explained about the Bechtel Corporation and the poison gas that Pollard's notes, according... You get my book, Surprise Freelabor, Zionism,
yes,
the Holocaust.
Yes,
you'll
sir.
Read all the experts that I gathered together on my side, working with me. But we exposed that the Bechtel Corporation, Casper Weinberger, George Shultz, they were all involved in Iran-Contra because of Pollard's information. I believe that to make sure that Pollard never gets out and this information never be spoken of, I believe that's why Ben Ami Kadosh was arrested. Nothing else works to explain the arrest of an 84-year-old retiree 23 years after his crime, except we got the truth out. It's the only explanation that makes sense to me.
Well, maybe you're right. I don't know that we'll ever find out for sure, but certainly the situation, there are a lot of people who are committing serious crimes. Some are part of major corporations, major banks are laundering money and helping not only terrorists, but drug smugglers. And what do they get? They get a little slap on the wrist, $50,000 fine, something like that. And of course, nobody goes to prison. But they're going to send this 84-year-old man to prison for something he did, 30 years ago? 20?
Nobody knows he did it. That's a separate issue, his guilt or not guilt. The point is Pollard will never get out because he was working with a broad network. That's the point.
Amen to that. Well, our guest this evening has been Barry Sammis. Always a pleasure, Barry, and we'll look forward to talking to you again next week and as we explore what's really going on behind the scenes, the news behind the news, the story behind the story. God bless you, Barry, and thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Bye, all.
All right, fine. I hope you've enjoyed our programs with Barry Sammis. I know I always do, and I hope you do as well. We'll be right back here. A lot of very strange things going on in the world. Incidentally, Barry and I do talk during all of the breaks. If you'd like to get a copy of our program, either on tape or CD, of course, you can call our 800 number, 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, because America is under attack today. Well, certainly we've been covering, Barry's covered a number of important issues, but I think the major underlying theme is that there are people in the United States who essentially control the Israeli government, Olmert, Hosni Peres, Barak, and even Netanyahu, of course, is a front for the Council on Foreign Relations. There is an invisible government that runs America. We do have a four-tape set on secret societies, and where you'll hear the interview with Professor Carol Quigley, Bill Clinton's mentor, talking about the secret society, about the emblem on the back of the dollar bill. And as he says, these crazy right-wingers are trying to tell me that that's a symbol of the Illuminati. Why, that's been around for 5,000 years, that pyramid, you know, at the eye above the pyramid, and he's absolutely right. It has been around for 5,000 years. It is the emblem of the ancient mystery religions, of the Luciferian religions. And so what's it doing on the back of the dollar bill? What's it doing in the right lower quadrant of the television screen there, the eye that you see on CBS? Remember, CBS, of course, was organized by Central Intelligence Agency, and the Central Intelligence Agency members were deeply involved with the mystery religions. And this whole move towards the New World Order, the New World Religion, the New World Leader. Well, to begin to put things together, we do hope that many of you want to get an excellent new DVD we're carrying by Savannah Gonzalez, who is a Cuban patriot, lives here in America, a historian, who's finally come to the same conclusion I did many years ago, and that is that the Council on Foreign Relations is a key organization, but what nobody will tell you is it's a front for a secret society. And the Professor Carol Quigley, who is Bill Clinton's mentor, who taught at Princeton and Harvard and then at Georgetown University, is a dedicated liberal and was part and parcel of this whole movement, explains all it's about in his book, Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time. And you can hear my interview with him in our Secret Society 4-tape set or in the Tragedy and Hope special. It's a book which you should get, you should read. It will change your life forever. That's Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time by Professor Carol Quigley, over 1,300 pages, where he really tells you their plan. As he says on pages 1247 and 1248, what we need is two political parties that are just about the same. And, of course, we can have the people throw the rascals out every 4 years, but the foreign and domestic policy will remain the same. And that's how the game is really played, ladies and gentlemen. To really understand it, I suggest the book Tragedy and Hope, available from Radio Liberty, now back in print, although it was suppressed for many years. And then, of course, our 4-tape set on secret societies, our 4-tape set on the secret government, and or the secret government special. And then, of course, there's Savannah Gonzalez's excellent DVD entitled Treason in America, the CFR. Treason in America, the CFR. Very good video. We certainly recommend it to you. And then, of course, we do hope that you'll get my talk on the planned police state. I mean, we need to get the syllabus because it will give you some of the documents that come from the Luciferians. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, there really are people who worship the dark side, who are deeply involved, of course, with the other dimension. And, of course, they have access to the power that is available there when you tap into the supernatural on the dark side. But, ladies and gentlemen, you don't want to do that because, of course, it will cost you your eternal soul. And then, of course, you need to get my talk on the forbidden knowledge. The forbidden knowledge is the syllabus that goes with that. And, of course, go to our website at RadioLiberty.com. You can listen to our programs there on the Internet at least 3 hours a day live. You can listen to our short wave broadcast. You can listen to archive programs. You can listen, certainly, to our MP3 programs. We are in shortwave. You can listen to those as well. We are in satellite. Telstar 5, and of course, you need to be, if you don't have ready access to us otherwise, you can get us through Telstar 5, and then please pray for America, but pray for Radio Liberty.
You're tuned to the Global Star Radio Network. Thanks for listening.
We'll be right back. afternoon. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Wherever you're situated on this great, big, beautiful blue globe floating through the void of God's creation, it is Thursday. It is the 1st of May, 2008. And yes, we touched upon a news item yesterday. We'll touch upon it again today after you see, if you have a computer and you can see this particular video, very difficult to watch, but you will understand why we asked the question, where is the line in the sand? This is Dave.
And Joyce, and I think that video shows perhaps what we've been talking about is who is really on the other side of this war. Is it really the bad guys with IEDs? Well, I think maybe we have new evidence that perhaps the war, as we have thought from the very beginning, was being perhaps fought by the same side, on both sides. And it's very disturbing, absolutely very disturbing. New reason why the YFZ compound, that Mormon quote-unquote compound that they identify in San Angelo, Texas, may have been targeted. You might understand why it is time or was time to talk.